The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Those are some sounds from the Pentagon released last night as the United States fired, I think, something like 60 Tomahawk cruise missiles at a Syrian airbase and destroyed a bit of the airstrip, according to Russian news agencies, 9 Syrian fighter jets, and I think about that many casualties, if we're to believe the Russian reports anyway. But that happened late last night, right in the middle of the night, I guess Syrian time, something like 8:40 p.m. Eastern Standard Time there in the United States. And I know we did spend a fair bit of time on this on yesterday's program, Richard Palmer filling in for me and talking about just what a dreadful week it's been with another chemical attack. On Tuesday, this after just last year, President Obama was saying that all of those chemical weapons have been removed. And here, there's another strike. Well, America finally struck back. Donald Trump, you'll recall on Wednesday, where he was in the Rose Garden talking about, well, this is worse than a red line. It crosses all kinds of lines. And it was President Obama, of course, years earlier, who drew the red line and then erased it. And so it didn't take long for Mr. Trump, President Trump, to follow through. You could tell from Wednesday's press conference that he was shaken by some of the images coming out of Syria. And so now America has intervened, at least with this attack, and you have lots of support coming out of Europe, coming from Israel, coming from Saudi Arabia. Here in the UK, the Telegraph says, this is one of the headlines, decisive Trump uses missile strikes to show Syria and the world there's a new sheriff in town. So there's a lot of people in the West applauding this. The Jerusalem Post had a headline that said, America is back. America is back. Not surprisingly, of course, Iran and Russia are very much against this action by the United States. They've voiced strong opposition to the airstrikes. But as Brett Stevens pointed out in a tweet this morning, when Putin and Khamenei both condemn you, it means that you've done something right. that he might be onto something, President Trump. Well, the Russian military says it's going to help to strengthen Syria's air defenses. And there's other reports, I guess, where a Russian rep is calling for an emergency meeting at the UN Security Council. In any event, shortly after the attack last night, this is what President Trump had to say down at Mar-a-Lago in Florida.
On Tuesday, Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad launched a horrible chemical weapons attack on innocent civilians. Using a deadly nerve agent, Assad choked out the lives of helpless men, women, and children. It was a slow and brutal death for so many. Even beautiful babies were cruelly murdered in this very barbaric attack. No child of God should ever suffer such horror. Tonight, I ordered a targeted military strike on the airfield in Syria from where the chemical attack was launched. It is in this vital national security interest of the United States to prevent and deter the spread and use of deadly chemical weapons. There can be no dispute that Syria used banned chemical weapons, violated its obligations under the Chemical Weapons Convention, and ignored the urging of the UN Security Council.
That's President Trump last night down in Florida. The New York Times, reporting on it this morning, says the events of Thursday night marked a dramatic turnabout for Mr. Trump, who until this week had displayed virtually no interest in a deeper role for the United States in the long, bloody conflict. I mean, it was just this week that his administration was talking about, you know, we're not trying to make a regime change in Syria. The New York Times goes on and says, well before he became a presidential candidate, Mr. Trump pleaded with Mr. Obama in 2013 to avoid the kind of strike that he has now ordered. Maybe he was pleading for President Obama not to take action, which he didn't, but he was all for it then. He's changed his tune this week, and again, as I said earlier, many are applauding it. It says, as recently as this week, before seeing images of dying children gasping for breath during the chemical attack, Mr. Trump and his top aides hardly appeared inclined to more forcefully assert American power in the country. But the change seemed to emerge during a Rose Garden news conference Wednesday afternoon, as Mr. Trump reacted to news and images of the attack with horror and a newfound desire to respond. And so respond he did late last night. Now, as I say, we've given quite a lot of coverage to this subject. Well, not just the attack, that's the most recent development here, but with the chemical attack on Tuesday, as I say, Richard talked about it yesterday on the program. Brent Noctegal had a piece earlier in the week about what's going to come of this mess in Syria. I mean, you talk about a toxic mix. You've got Assad's forces. You've got the resistance to his forces. You've got Iran in play. You've got Russia, of course. We handed it over to Russia in 2013. And then now the United States is firing missiles into Syria. But going back to 2013, and Richard brought this out yesterday, here we were saying, well, you can take over Russia. That's fine. And we'll trust you to remove all of those chemical weapons. And Richard brought out a good point in his article yesterday. I think this was also in the Trumpet brief and on the program, but he was talking about, I mean, these are the same people, the previous administration, I mean, the Obama administration. The same ones that say they've stopped Iran from getting a nuclear bomb. And so here they were saying that all the chemical weapons have been removed, and they just got used on Tuesday. And all these babies, these children dying, gassed to death. It is a horrible atrocity. But it is important, too, for us to step back and look at the bigger picture and how this is going to impact a number of prophecies. Going back to that development in 2013, when we handed it over to Russia, my father had this to say: this man has done more to keep Bashar Assad, he's talking about Putin, to keep Assad in power in Syria than any other leader in the world. Russian weapons have probably been the main factor preserving Assad's rule. Putin's backing of the Syrian regime is a major reason Assad has been so willing to slaughter his opposition by the tens of thousands. In addition, Putin wants to restrict America's power in the Middle East and everywhere else, and to strengthen his own. Really, it's amazing that Russia hasn't gotten stronger criticism from the world community. I guess it did at the UN Tuesday or Wednesday with the U.S. ambassador there. I mean, she gave a strong speech condemning what Russia was just turning a blind eye to. My father wrote in 2013, though, about handing this over to Russia. He said, what a farce. What a farce. This is a man who invaded Georgia. Well, he goes down the track record of Vladimir Putin. And the fact that the Obama administration would be so happy to just hand it over and to trust Putin to disarm Syria. In fact, it's Putin that's propped up Assad's regime. That's what he was saying in that 2013 article. It says, now Putin is conducting the peace process of all things. This is from 2013. The Obama administration is trusting this man to put Assad's weapons of mass destruction under international control and to guarantee Assad can no longer terrorize his people. That's what we were doing in 2013. And then this week, we saw what a farce it has been. Assad killing his own people, killing Syrian citizens with the worst kind of attack you could imagine. Well, where is this leading? What will be the outcome in that tangled web that is Syria? It's been going on for 6 years. Hundreds of thousands of people killed in the crossfire. Millions more that have fled the nation. Brent Nachtigall, he had a piece, I believe, on Wednesday earlier this week at the website, talking about how Assad's strike on Tuesday, it really does put him in a tenuous position. Brent says, watch for the U.S. government to assemble a possible coalition of the willing in order to further isolate the Assad regime in Syria. So far, Russia has stayed in lockstep with supporting Assad, Brent said, but this could change with the right leverage and concessions. Also, look for Europe to potentially become more vocal and affirming of President Trump's stand on Syria. That's what we wrote a couple of days ago. And then you look what's happened now following that strike last night. Europe showing enthusiastic support for it. And the position of Assad looking all the more tenuous. If you followed us for very long, you know where this is leading. You know that it's leading to a Middle East realignment. I think Richard played this clip for you yesterday from my father's 2012 Key of David program. It's the one he gave on the Psalm 83 Alliance.
But this Psalm 83 indicates that Syria is going to have a break with Iran, that they're going to break away. Now, you don't see much of that in the headlines today, but you do see enough violence there to see where it might be able to do that. But most people don't draw that conclusion. We do because we've been prophesying it for, well, close to 20 years now.
That's from my father's program back in 2012. This prophesied break between Syria and Iran. And what's amazing about that Psalm 83 prophecy is there's more detail than just Syria and Iran splitting apart. I thought this article that I received this morning, this is from the Wall Street Journal, about the clear winner of this Syrian civil war. The journal says Hezbollah, founded in the early 1980s to fight Israel's occupation of southern Lebanon, became involved in the civil war next door to protect its patrons in Damascus and a supply line of Iranian weapons. So it has interests at play here as well. and it's been involved from the beginning. It says, after years of growing engagement, including training thousands of mostly Shiite Muslim fighters and beginning to provide social services, Hezbollah is today stronger, more independent, and in command of a new Syrian militia that its officials say is ready to be deployed to other conflicts in the region. It says here that Hezbollah now fights alongside Russian troops, its first alliance with a global power. I mean, it's got more clout than it did 6 years ago. It's more powerful than it was a few years back. It talks about some of the leads that Hezbollah has taken in the battlefield plan for Aleppo, for instance. Later on, it says, thanks to money and arms from Tehran, Hezbollah now stands almost on par with Iran as a protector of President Bashar al-Assad's government. It's almost on a par with Iran, Hezbollah's influence, Hezbollah's power there in Syria. It says, with its growing might, this arch foe of Israel, a group long labeled terrorist by the U.S., has gained a modicum of international recognition. It participated in negotiations sponsored by Russia following the rout of rebels from Aleppo. It says, even before the Syrian civil war, Hezbollah had evolved beyond its guerrilla group origins into a business and political enterprise. Talks about some of the social services and such that it's provided the people of Lebanon. It says now it's poised to capitalize on what many Middle East analysts expect will be an eventual end to the Syrian war that leaves Mr. Assad in power. Well, we don't know so. That means that's changed even since yesterday. He's in a tenuous position, like Brent covered in his piece. But could we be coming to the end of the Syrian civil war? And what will happen when the dust settles? It's interesting what the journal has to say about Hezbollah's position in all of this. It says, U.S. and Israeli officials have watched the growth of Hezbollah with concern, worried it could draw on its Syrian recruits to pressure Israel from a new front along the Golan Heights. It says later, Israel knows that what has happened in Syria has changed Hezbollah, which has developed from not just defending against Israel, but attacking it. That's quoting from a senior official. It says later, it's now developed traditional and non-traditional means of war. Damascus was once considered a Hezbollah proxy master, but Western diplomats say the Lebanese group is carving out its own zones of influence across Syria by training local fighters. And then notice this. Ryan Crocker, a former U.S. ambassador to both Iraq and Syria, said the autonomy Hezbollah enjoys in Syria arises partly because Iraq is more important for Iran in many ways than Syria is, while to Hezbollah, next door Syria is more important. And so you begin to see this realignment. Even in the way Hezbollah's come through all of this, stronger. And now Assad's position appears to be quite tenuous. And then what does the Bible prophesy? Well, we've told you for 20-some years about Iran taking over Iraq. That's happened. And like the journal brings out, I mean, it's quoting from Ryan Crocker, this former U.S. ambassador. But he says Iraq's more important for Iran. And with respect to Syria, I mean, that's more important to Hezbollah. And so what happens when you have this break between Syria and Iran? Well, it follows then that Hezbollah also is going to realign. My father wrote in this article from 2012, how the Syrian crisis will end. We'll have to post this on the front of the website today as well, if we didn't do that yesterday. In any event, it's from August of 2012. It's 5 years old. And it talks about Psalm 83 and how it reveals a tremendous amount of what what we know will happen. My father says here, Gibal, modern-day Lebanon, is home today to the Iranian terrorist puppet Hezbollah. We can expect it to also switch allegiance. That's what he said in 2012, right at the early stages of the Syrian civil war. We can expect Hezbollah to switch allegiance. Later on, he says, Iran has recently led Hezbollah and the Palestinians in their terrorist activities. They all share some common enemies, especially America and Israel, but they have some different views in religion and politics, which could cause Hezbollah and the Palestinians to ally themselves with Germany. He says also there may soon be some significant power shifts in Lebanon and Gaza. So that prophecy, I mean, it really does make this Wall Street Journal piece, I think, quite interesting. Just to conclude from the journal, it says, in Syria, Hezbollah is playing for lasting political and social influence. It says according to Western and Arab diplomats, among Hezbollah supporters in Syria, deference to the Damascus regime is eroding. So we see things beginning to break down in this alliance between Iran and Syria. And now with the U.S. back in there, I mean, it's not going to turn out great for the United States in the end either. But what's happening, even as recently as just overnight, could certainly accelerate this realignment that's prophesied in Psalm 83. Well, there's another piece here. I guess I can go ahead and just touch on it before we take a break. It has to do with China. He's meeting with President Xi, Mr. Trump is, that is. I guess he was yesterday, and then broke away from the meetings and announced that he had authorized the attack, that Tomahawk missile attack on the Syrian base. But he's meeting there at Mar-a-Lago with the Chinese premier. And Daily Beast has a piece here. Trump's America First approach abandons the Monroe Doctrine and puts China ahead. It talks about him hosting President Xi at Mar-a-Lago and how that, you know, there has to be a few awkward moments, or there had to have been at the start anyway, because throughout his campaign, as you know, Donald Trump was talking about how America doesn't win anymore and how that we keep losing to China. I mean, that was one of his best known phrases on the campaign trail. We keep losing to China. We're getting ripped off. Well, this piece at the Daily Beast says, what Trump has failed to recognize or acknowledge is that Chinese expansion into regions that have traditionally been under the American umbrella of influence, particularly in the Western Hemisphere, means that his America First approach would effectively cede these regions to China and play into its case for being a global superpower. I mean, it does bring out in this piece how that there is a huge trade imbalance. I forget where it is in the article. It gives some figures later on. But there's a huge trade imbalance. And okay, the Trump administration wants to straighten that out. But at the same time, he's saying America must come first. He's turning inward. That's really the position he's even taken on the Middle East, which is why some are, I think, surprised by the action that he took last night. It's unpredictable, some of his foreign policy approaches. But with respect to China and trade and getting a fair deal, and then what he talked about at the inauguration and even since, if America turns inward, what does it do about all of these gains that China has been making? I mean, not just over in the South China Sea, but right in America's backyard. That's what this article is talking about. I won't take the time to get into all of the investments that China has been making in the Caribbean, Central America, and so on. It says further, though, this is toward the end of the article, the Monroe Doctrine makes clear that interference in the Western Hemisphere would be viewed as the manifestation of an unfriendly disposition toward the United States. While it was originally written to counter European expansion, it should be applied to China today as its aggressive expansion threatens the United States and its interests. President Trump must counter China's moves, but to do so would mean abandoning his American First policy. Not doing so would effectively be ending nearly 200 years of American policy and attitude toward the Western Hemisphere. It says, should Trump fail to do so, it would not be losing to China. As he has repeatedly put it, Trump would be surrendering to China without even a fight. Now, you know, one thing President Trump has been saying quite frequently is that he inherited a mess, not just at home in the United States, but he inherited a mess in the Middle East with China, with trade, with North Korea. And he's right about that. I thought it was interesting at the end of, I should have included this clip, I suppose, but at the end of that statement last night, he asked for God to bless the United States and the whole world. And yet you look at this world, and it's obviously not being blessed. The United States is not being blessed. You would think more people would see that. In any event, he is right that he inherited a mess. But God's not going to start blessing it all of a sudden, whether it's the Middle East or in the South China Sea or wherever. There's another article that was at Real Clear World this morning. 6 reasons the U.S.-China relations are headed for trouble. I mean, there's just so many hot spots. The tremendous trade imbalance, the China's aggression in the East China Sea and the South China Sea. Taiwan is a flashpoint, of course. And then you throw North Korea into the mix. It's a crazy and dangerous world. The danger is obvious. This is the point made at Real Clear. I think with respect to, let me just read it. It says, eventual outright control of the South China Sea would give Beijing tremendous leverage throughout the region. Well, it just talks about the trillions of dollars of trade, goods and services that pass through that sea, that waterway. $1.2 trillion of which is U.S. trade. I mean, and you hand that over to the Chinese? You think about all those prophecies about the United States and Britain being frozen out. Trade war. Well, we'll have to certainly keep our eye on those meetings and what comes out from those meetings that President Trump had with the Chinese president down in Florida yesterday. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, if we have some time later on at the end of the show, we'll run through as many emails as we can. Quite a few more responses to the Trumpet briefs that have gone out over this past week. If you'd like to email us separately from that, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
With the spring holy days, God's annual holy day festival is now just around the corner. I thought it'd be good to just review some of the history there early on in the book of Exodus. I think this is history that quite a few of our listeners are very familiar with. It is good to be reminded of it, particularly at this time of year. If you look at the first chapter of Exodus, there were tremendous changes that took place over the course of 2 centuries or so. I mean, when Joseph went down there, God used him in a miraculous way and ended up blessing Egypt and then the Israelites that followed him down there. But over time, that began to change. And this is brought out in Exodus chapter 1, verse 9, it says, "And he said unto his people, Behold," this is a new Pharaoh that comes on the scene, "Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. And it come to pass that when there falls out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us. And so get them up out of the land." So this new ruler in Egypt, he became fearful of Israel, its growing numbers, worried that Israel would be mightier than the Egyptians. And so the Egyptians started to oppress the Israelites. They made life difficult and very bitter for God's people. This is carrying on. Verse 11 says, "Therefore they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Python and Ramses." So he made them slaves. He made them slaves, and Israel was crying out for deliverance. You know the story. You know the history. I mean, things were going wrong for the Israelites. And that happens. That happens to nations, in fact. I mean, we can't, as Americans, just sit here and think, "Oh, well, now we've made a strike against Assyrian air base. America's back. Everything's back to normal. We're the most powerful. We're the superpower again." And yet still, you can, if you look, if your eyes are open to the truth, you can see the same sickness is there. The same will is broken. And it gets down to disobedience to God's laws. That's always what it comes down to. God said in the Old Testament that commandment keeping is what makes us strong. That's what Moses told the Israelites from the very beginning. God said, "You keep these commandments. And if you do, I mean, you're going to be the envy of the world as people look at you and they marvel at your strength and your power and your prosperity." Well, we have received all of that in these latter days, but not because of our own obedience to God's laws, not because of our faithfulness, but because of the faithfulness and the obedience of that great patriarch Abraham. God promised his descendants would be the recipients of all of these tremendous blessings of wealth and prosperity and power. And we've received them, sure enough. Herbert Armstrong writes about this in the United States and Britain in Prophecy. We've received those blessings. And as he brings out in that book, I mean, once God kept his promise of distributing those blessings, then it's on us. It's on us to keep them, to preserve them. We've seen this story play out over and over again. It's happened in spiritual Israel. Look at what happened to God's church after Herbert Armstrong died. I mean, here it was a strong church, an obedient church for the most part. And then as soon as Herbert Armstrong died, sin set in and the people degenerated and problems came into the church. Verse 12 here in Exodus, going back to this history with ancient Israel, it says, "But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were grieved because of the children of Israel." So the numbers did not dwindle, and the Egyptian leaders became that much more concerned. And so they piled it on even more. It says in verse 13, "And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and in brick and in all manner of service in the field. All their service, wherein they made them serve, was with rigor. So they were, I mean, these were oppressive conditions. They were slaves. And of course, God was setting all of this up to teach us a lesson spiritually. It's all there for our learning, as it says in 1 Corinthians 10. Here in verse 15, it says, "And the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives." Well, he told the Hebrew midwives, "You kill off all of these Hebrew boys, these little babies." And the midwives disobeyed that command. It says they feared God. They feared God, and they didn't do what the king of Egypt commanded. And so verse 22, it says, "And Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every son that's born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive." So he took matters into his own hands. The midwives disobeyed, and he said, all right, he charged his own people, every Hebrew son, every Israelite boy that's born, you cast into the river. And we don't even know how many Israelite boys were murdered because of this decree. But this is the backdrop. This is the backdrop for our being introduced to a famous Israelite boy, a baby boy, a special boy. His parents knew that he was special from the beginning. This is the backdrop for our being introduced to Moses. Moses' life, it's pretty amazing when you study it. I think Dennis Leap has a series going on right now in the Royal Vision magazine. But here for 40 years, I mean, he was brought up for the most part as a prince of Egypt. And then that was followed by 40 years when he was just a lowly shepherd in Midian. And then the final 40 years, when he was an old man, he was Israel's deliverer. God used him to deliver the Israelites out of captivity. Well, going back to when he was just a little infant, verse 1 of chapter 2 says, "And there went a man of the house of Levi and took to wife a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bare a son, and when she saw him, that he was a goodly child, she hid him for 3 months." Goodly means excellent or valuable. She saw something special in this little boy, and she hid him for 3 months. In the book of Hebrews, by the way, it says that by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents because they saw he was a proper child and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. So Paul draws attention to the faith of Moses' parents. He had a special family, special siblings. This was a family that really was dedicated to serving God. Here in Exodus 2, verse 3 says, "And when she could no longer hide him, she took him for an ark of bulrushes and daubed it with slime and with pitch and put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the river's bank." So Moses was put in his own little Noah's Ark, you could call it. This was his place of protection. And there he was, floating down the river under his sister's supervision, and then picked up by Pharaoh's daughter. Verse 7 says, "Then said his sister to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call to you a nurse of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. And the maid went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, take this child away and nurse it for me, and I will give you your wages. And the woman took the child and nursed it." I mean, this is amazing, really, when you see the way God set this all up. I mean, here is his real mother, Moses' real mom, was paid to watch and to nurse her own son. These were the miracles that God was working out from the beginning. Early on, I mean, at least in those first few years, it's quite possible that Moses spent quite a lot of time with his real family, his mom, his dad, his brothers, sisters. Verse 10 says, and the child grew, and she brought him into Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she called his name Moses, and she said, because I drew him out of the water. And so from that point forward, perhaps when he was 3-4 years of age, up until 40, Moses is raised right there in the king's palace. He was a military man in Egypt. He was a learned man. Verse 11 says, and it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown, that he went out unto his brethren, and he looked on their burdens, and he spied an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So here is this mighty prince of Egypt. And he knew. He took note of these Hebrew slaves. He knew they were being mistreated. He knew they were oppressed. And here he sees this dispute. He sees this taskmaster really abusing this little, or smiting this Hebrew. It says in verse 12, and he looked this way and that way, and when he saw there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. He didn't think anybody was watching. He took matters into his own hands. Obviously, this was a carnal approach to delivering the Israelites, or in this case, this lone Israelite. Verse 13 says, and when he went out the second day, behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together, and he said to them that did the wrong, wherefore smite you your fellow? And he said, who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? And Moses feared and said, surely this thing is known. He thought he had gotten away with murder. But now it was out. This was something he had tried to keep quiet. But now, evidently, quite a few people knew about it, at least among the Hebrews. Verse 15, now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses, and Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. So this takes us into this second phase of his life out in the wilderness. Stephen recounted this history in Acts 7. This is when Stephen, the deacon, is answering his accusers. He's going through some of this same history from the early chapters of Exodus. It says in Acts 7, verse 17, but when the time of the promise drew near, which God had sworn to Abraham, and the people grew and multiplied in Egypt till another king arose, which knew not Joseph, the same dealt subtly with our kindred, and evil entreated our fathers, so that they cast out their young children, to the end they might not live. It says, in which time Moses was born, and was exceeding fair, and nourished up in his father's house 3 months. And when he was cast out, Pharaoh's daughter took him up and nourished him for her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and was mighty in words and in deeds. He was educated in Egyptian schools. Josephus says he was a great military man. He was exposed to all of these Egyptian customs and religions even. And yet he was well aware of the struggles of his own people. Verse 23, and when he was a full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. It came into his heart. He had compassion for his own people. Verse 24 says, and seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him and avenged him that was oppressed and smote the Egyptian, for he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them, but they understood not. So Moses, he just assumed that they knew he was going to be their deliverer. They didn't think that way. They didn't think the way that he did about himself. The next day, well, I'll just paraphrase what we read previously in Exodus. Let me switch over again to Hebrews 11. Remember the faith of his parents. They knew he was a proper child, and they weren't afraid of the king's commandment. It says in Hebrews 11, verse 23. Verse 24 says, by faith, this talks now about Moses, by faith, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Egypt is a type of sin. This is why we should be well familiar with this history and observing God's holy days so that we're reminded of this every single year. Passover, the days of unleavened bread, coming out of Egypt, coming out of sin. Moses chose to suffer affliction with God's people rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. It says in verse 26, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. He forsook Egypt, and he fled into the land of Midian. Now back to Exodus 2, and we can just finish up back here in the book of Exodus. It says, when Pharaoh heard all of this, he sought to slay Moses. And so Moses fled. He went out into the land of Midian there, where he met up with Jethro and married one of Jethro's daughters. And then look at verse 23. It says, and it came to pass, I mean, a lot of time is covered here, but it says, and it came to pass in process of time that the king of Egypt died. So time had passed, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage. And they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage, it says. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so God had this remarkable exchange with his servant Moses, who by this point he's pushing 80 years of age. It says, now Moses, this is Exodus 3:1, now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the backside of the desert. I mean, he's all the way at the end of the desert, basically, right there by Mount Horeb. And he came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. And it says, and the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. Well, I don't have time to get into everything that's said here, but it's a remarkable conversation. And Moses' attitude is very different. It's very different now that he's almost 80 and had been in the wilderness for 40 years. Very different than when he just assumed that everyone knew he was a deliverer. Now he protested. Now God said, I need you to deliver these people. And Moses said, I can't do this. And he put forward, I think it's 5 or 6 reasons why he couldn't. And God kept saying, yes, you can. And then at the end of the exchange, with respect to the speech impediment, he said, look, your brother Aaron will help you. He didn't just heal him instantaneously of the impediment, whatever it was. He said, your brother will help you. Just look to me. And Moses did do that. Well, there's lots and lots of history. The story doesn't end there, as you know. It really is just the beginning, but perhaps that will whet your appetite to dig into those early chapters of the book of Exodus. The book of Exodus, a story of redemption. When we come back, I'll try to get through as many emails as possible here with the few minutes that we have remaining. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The world is hopelessly confused about Bible history and prophecy. Understanding the Daniel 2 image could clear up most of that confusion. The Daniel 2 image gives an overview of history and prophecy like nothing else in the Bible. The Bible is a masterful work that should be studied in its entirety. The book of Daniel and the images described therein actually unlock the meaning of the prophecies in the book of Revelation. Our free booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, explains the incredible prophecies contained in these two books. Studied alongside your Bible, this booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, will bring the history and prophecy of your Bible to life. Request your free copy today. There is absolutely no cost or obligation. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program.
My father's latest television program posted just today at thetrumpet.com, The Mystery of Israel, the Bible. As you know, at least you should know, it's a book about Israel. I gave you a little bit of that history just in the last segment. The early stages of Israel's exodus out of Egypt. So much symbolism. And why would the Bible, from beginning to end, be about Israel, whether physical or spiritual? And why ancient Israel? Mr. Armstrong covers that in his book, Mystery of the Ages. That's the latest installment of that series my father's putting together on Mystery of the Ages. The Mystery of Israel, posted today. He told me on the phone just yesterday that he was really happy with the one that he taped this week on the Mystery of the Church. And that'll be coming out next week. So make sure that you watch The Mystery of Israel at thetrumpet.com. Over the past week, we've gained 155 new subscribers to the Trumpet Brief, so we're keeping up with some pretty impressive growth numbers over the past several weeks. I think the first couple weeks we were up over 200, and then we've had a little bit of a dip in the weekly figures, but 155 over the last 7 days, some strong numbers there. And here are some of the responses to those daily emails that we're sending out. One here says, thank you very much for putting this message out. I hope these messages keep coming. Another one writes, I love these briefs. Please continue. And then here's a longer one that says, thank you. Thank you all for incorporating the Trumpet Brief with the work. It's amazing how the brief can generate requests, and you have already mentioned the increase of literature distributions to the world. I'm trying to reply for the first time to the brief, which is also a wonderful way to generate positive feedback. I really like it when you read the email responses on the air. It gives me hope for spiritual growth, and it's a nice reinforcement of the topics covered. I've been a coworker for almost 3 years and hope to continue. He goes on and talks about how often he watches the musicals that God's church has produced, the Isaiah musical, the Jeremiah musical, and he watches them with his little daughter, 11 months old. But it says toward the end just how positive all of this is, and he's really appreciative of all of the programs. He mentions The Sun Also Rises with Jeremiah Jacques. He's anxious, he says, for the next season of Live by Every Word, and he regularly listens to the Trumpet Daily and also Trumpet Hour. So an excellent response there. Another one here, in response to Britain's prophesied divorce from the EU, this is the Trumpet Brief that went out about a week ago. I just have to thank you and the new format for having that October 2nd, 2007 article by Brad McDonald where I could read it for myself. That's one vivid word picture. Makes it easier to assimilate when I can see the words and process them. Strong, strong prophecy. I just love thetrumpet.com and everything you put out there. Actually, I can't keep up, but I keep trying. Another one here. I've been getting the Trumpet magazine for quite a few years now. Often mimicked and never equaled, I'm finding with other so-called prophetic magazines. A subscription is very important in these uncertain times. Another one here says, firstly, a request for the Philadelphia Trumpet magazine. My details are above. And then secondly, may the richest blessings of God's amazing love continue to guide you. We got quite a few in response to the brief from last Friday, I believe. Rotten Tomatoes for the new Churchill movie. This one here says, respectfully, I think your understanding is somewhat inaccurate. And before I am decried as a lefty of some sort, please know that I am a staunch conservative and rather pro-UK. So I assume that's one from the UK that didn't agree with our take on that new movie coming out. Most of them did, however. It says, interesting how untruths of great men like Mr. Churchill get such a bad rap from those who have no clue. Another one here says, what a miraculous issue of the Trumpet Brief, featuring one of my favorite heroes, Winston Churchill. Another one here says, thanks for all the news. I'll be sure not to see the Churchill movie. There's no reason to fill one's head with a bunch of false information about this Watchman. And then finally, thank you for the information. I must read the truthful knowledge on Churchill and the information on abortion. Well, he goes on to just talk about the abortion article that we posted at thetrumpet.com last week as well, and just how powerful that message was. But with that, I'm out of time, so I'll have to close it off there and hopefully get to some more email responses sometime next week. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us this weekend, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us this week, and we'll see you next week.